this morning, United States versus Gilcrease. Right? Yeah. Mr. Epstein?
Good morning, judges. May it please the court. I'm Jason Epstein. I represent Kendricks Gilcrease. He's the defendant appellant in this matter. Judge, a couple of housekeeping matters. First, I've already reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal. Also, I stand on any issues that we don't address today, specifically on my brief. I'd like to just say that. Also, there was a note to me that we may address the issue of redaction. That was some litigation that occurred in the Seventh Circuit regarding that. If the court wishes me to address that, I will. If not, I will continue on to our argument.
Do you have any? Okay, we've got a transcript, an unredacted transcript of the in-camera discussion of the defendant's efforts at cooperation. Is there anything in that you think needs to stay under seal?
Judge, I submitted a redaction, and only specifically, may this be not part of my time, or is it, since it's kind of housekeeping?
Well, we'll figure that out at the end.
Go ahead. Okay. All right. What I redacted out were specific references to unique items that were talked about. There were no names. No names were discussed. However,
the gun. You mean the gun?
Yes. So the type of gun it was, and also the locus of the lower court is what I attempted to redact. Just those two things, I think, is sufficient. That was all I was really worried about, that if – I don't think there's anybody here today. I looked around, but if this were to get out, that they could, because the characteristics were so specific, they could know – because there were arrests made, and I would hate for my client to be tied to those arrests with those very specific weapons and in that locus, because, of course, they probably wouldn't exact revenge on Mr. Gilcrease. It would probably be upon his family, and I'd hate to risk that.
Well, we'll hear what the government has to say about the redaction, and then.
And as to that, as itself, I don't rely on it. I think the government will, and I don't think it's necessarily relevant. And I'll point out why in the whole of my argument as to why I don't believe that was part of it. I think it was to the wayside only because it was very relevant to the appellant. One other housekeeping matter, Judge. I did receive a case from the government as a supplement before argument today, and it's the United States versus Combs case where they're contesting jurisdiction. Their argument is basically that because he waived his appellant rights, that this court has no jurisdiction to hear the matter at all. However, I would point to... I believe it looks like 567 of that case, and this court specifically addressed that issue. It was raised that whether an explicit waiver of appellate rights in a plea agreement affects the court's jurisdiction, and this court said the answer is no. According to these decisions, and that is our position as well, and they cite other circuits, it's saying that basically that a plea agreement does not deprive this court of jurisdiction, and because it would be bootstrapping. The plea agreement, because it has to be voluntary, if we couldn't review that, then you would not know whether or not it was voluntary. It's circular, and that's why they don't do it, in my opinion. However, that case in and of itself states specifically that they address the issue. This court has jurisdiction. Waiving an appellate rights in the plea is not sufficient to deprive the court of jurisdiction. That case dealt with pre-plea issues like motion to suppress. If you waive that issue, then this court doesn't have jurisdiction to review that because you waived it. But if that does not include the plea, that case specifically addresses it, and they say, no, that's not the case. The court has jurisdiction. Moving to the substance, if there's any questions on that, I don't want to talk too fast. I've been accused of that many times. Okay. Moving to the substance of the case, Judge, procedurally, it is impossible for the government to win this. It's procedurally impossible, and here's why. In their response brief to my brief, they allege one argument and one argument only. They argue the contractual issue. In this case, it was a plea agreement. We attacked the plea as a contract and the voluntary and knowing nature. Those were the two arguments that the appellant make. The response only addresses the contractual issue. because voluntary is a threshold issue, and there are many cases that say that, United States versus Jeffries, 265 F3rd 556, this court said it's a threshold issue. I don't think that's a position that's going to be contested. It is a threshold issue. Because it is, because voluntariness is a threshold issue, if you don't address that, we don't get to the contractual issue. Because they only address the contract, they waive my argument on voluntary and knowing under Rule 11.
So you think we ought to just summarily reverse this morning?
Absolutely.
Theory?
Yes, Judge.
You don't see a linkage between the voluntariness and the contractual issues?
They do argue that. And I don't want it to seem like I'm trying to mislead the court, because they do argue the voluntariness, but they only argue it in attempt to hold Mr. Kilcrease to the contract. It's kind of an overview and an underview. The overview is, I argued Rule 11. They don't respond to Rule 11. They chose the structure of their argument. They don't respond to it. However, in arguing their contractual basis, they say that he agreed, and therefore, and it was voluntary when he agreed that term. And I agree, it is a procedural issue.
That's what the whole Rule 11 colloquy is intended to determine, right?
Exactly. It is, but that's not how they argue it. That is not how they argue it, Judge.
Let's not quibble with the way the government chose to
Absolutely,
frame its
Judge.
Argument
and
get on
be...
to the meat of your argument.
Yeah. Absolutely, Judge. The plea involved two promises that we have issue with. One comes under paragraph 18. And in paragraph 18, the defendant agreed not to make certain arguments at the sentencing. And in return for that, the government would make a motion for a downward departure, which would basically take Mr. Kilcrease out of the life sentence realm. The government does not address that issue. They do not address paragraph 18. I point that out in my reply brief that they have waived that issue also. Paragraph 18, they never address that particular promise. And there are two promises. That's one of them. It's completely unaddressed. And this court has no basis to refute that why they didn't. United States versus Wade says the government must say why they didn't complete performance. Now, because there were two contracts, the government could argue, two promises, the government could argue that, well, it was both promises, and based on both promises, then the government would be obligated to move for downward departure. They could argue that. However, that's not clear in the agreement at all. I'm an attorney. I went through it. I didn't see that was spelled out. Because it's an ambiguity, ambiguities are construed against the drafter, and the government drafted this plea agreement. And, of course, we're talking about Kendrick Kilcrease, who has a ninth-grade education, a history of heroin and alcohol abuse. And he's the one that's supposed to discern these issues, which even for me took me a while to wrap my head around this. Now, that's the first issue, that they don't address it. Secondly, cooperation. Now, this, I'm afraid, is going to get muddied by the redaction issue, that other issue that we have, and I hope that it doesn't. The government agreed with the defendant, if he cooperated and gave up some people, that they would move for a downward departure. However, this is why I believe the redaction issue is a non-issue. It's in the government's sole discretion. That means that not even that the government has the sole discretion, not even the executive can review it. Not I, the defense counsel, can review it. It is in the government's sole discretion whether or not they should move for downward departure. So a qualitative analysis of that redaction issue, that in-camera proceeding, he could have given up 20 guys. And there could have been convictions on those 20 guys. And they could say no. And contractually, if we were to hold them to the contract, it would be a good contract. It's in their sole discretion. There is no review of sole discretion. United States versus Garcia had a similar issue. They were debating about the terms of the contract, and the government offered at argument that the terms should be wholly discretionary. And the court, the First Circuit Court in United States versus Garcia said, no, we won't accept wholly discretionary because wholly discretionary is an illusory term. It is illusory. It is not a promise at all. And the restatement echoes that if the promise doesn't promise anything, it's not a promise. It looks like a promise. Now, in my brief, we're talking about, again, a ninth-grade education individual. And the cases say that where the illusory promise induces the person to the contract, then it will not be upheld. And here we have a ninth-grade individual who has a history of drug abuse. Was he induced by the other promises? The other promises were a downward departure for acceptance of responsibility and so forth. And they're for naught. Why? Because it's in the government's sole discretion to move away from the life sentence. And what good is a downward departure for acceptance of responsibility if you have a life sentence? It's nonsensical. And all of this was... it was just dressing on the cake, is the way I put it in my brief. It's dressing on the cake. Mr. Kilcrease didn't understand it, and I addressed that later, which was another issue in itself. So what we have is an illusory contract. The government can't hold a ninth grade, couldn't even hold an attorney to this, much less an individual who has a ninth grade education, to sole discretion. That's their terminology. They chose it. It's held against the drafter. I see my time is now in the red, Judge. Are there any questions at this point?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. Joe Hartzler on behalf of the United States.
We've been told it's impossible for you to win.
Well, I don't really follow that. I think that we've argued the Rule 11 question starting on page 26 of our brief. I don't see that it's isolated to the contract question. I mean, I agree that there are really two issues that are raised. One is whether or not the plea agreement contract should be nullified or is illusory, as he says, is the first argument. And for that, you look at the four corners of the plea agreement and the plea colloquy. And if that were the only issue in this case, we wouldn't have an issue of redaction because you could just send the sentencing transcript back to the district court. You can send the sealed transcript, which routinely happens when the district court mistakenly sends up a sealed document. But there's a secondary issue that I think is the weaker of the two arguments, and if it were withdrawn, which I recommended, but that's not going to happen, we wouldn't have to face a redaction issue. But I think the problem with having a sealed transcript before the court on which you will have to base your decision on whether or not the issue being whether the government complied with the terms of the plea agreement. We've got to review the sentencing transcript. The sentencing transcript has got to include the sealed transcript. I'm not sure that it serves the appearance of integrity of the process to have portions of the transcript redacted. The problem with that is we have an officer of the court that's represented that it may jeopardize the life of Mr. Kilcrease if those little details are revealed. Again, I think the dilemma should not be, I mean, we shouldn't be held hostage to that. If Mr. Kilcrease thinks his life is in such jeopardy, if those details are revealed, then he ought to withdraw the argument, the second argument, which I think is the weaker of the two arguments. If that doesn't happen, I don't see any alternative the court has than unsealing the entire transcript and deciding the issue. Let me just go back to the...
On that point, Mr. Hartzler... The key point simply seemed to be that there was modest cooperation, not great results, some details involving an unusual weapon, and that was about it. Does that suffice for your purposes on that point?
Right. That's why I didn't have to, in my brief, refer to the sealed transcript. That's correct.
But I'm trying to figure out how much you felt restrained.
No, I didn't feel restrained. I just think that it's a question of the process, that for the public to see the court making a decision based on a transcript that stays sealed with information that's not disclosed to the court but was disclosed to the district court, I think is very awkward and subjects all of us to questions about the integrity of the process, really what it amounts to. In terms of can you address the issue, obviously our brief did, and I think that the court could without revealing those minor details. And I don't think the argument is that those minor details would affect that decision, would affect the decision of the district court or certainly of this court.
Sure.
And of course, the other thing about it is the standard is clearly going to be plain error because there was no objection to any of this below. So I don't think you could say that those details would tip the balance one way or the other. I hope that answers your question. Let me just go back to the first remark about the jurisdiction. There's no question this court has jurisdiction. That's why I sent in that Rule 28J letter. Our position, in the brief, the jurisdictional statement says that the court does not have jurisdiction, and the 28J letter says, yes, it does, based on that recent decision of Coombe. So there's no dispute of the parties as to whether there's jurisdiction.
Right. Appeal waivers turn on the enforceability of the plea to which they attach.
I didn't hear the last two words.
The appeal waivers turn on the enforceability of the plea to which they attach, and that's really the
right.
The sole merits question here.
Right. It is a merits question, but as I understand it, the court will typically dismiss the appeal if it finds a valid appeal waiver. It just doesn't do so on the basis of no jurisdiction.
Right, and it's not a merits dismissal or a merits ruling in the traditional sense that we're ruling on claims of error. We're ruling on the enforceability of the appeal waiver.
Well, you and I agree.
Okay, now that we've clarified that. What is there anything unenforceable about this appeal waiver? The illusory argument has been made here that he didn't get much because he's subject to a life term, regardless here, and that he's totally at the whim of the government on the substantial assistance motion.
Well, I don't know if you could say it's the whim. We have to operate in good faith. Clearly, it's within the sole discretion of the government. The statute provides that it's within the sole discretion of the government to decide whether or not to seek a sentence beneath the mandatory minimum. It did not in this case. You saw from the unsealed portion of the originally sealed transcript that the cooperation was not especially significant, and that the government chose to suggest that Mr. Kilcrease exercise the option of seeking a Rule 35 reduction. That's the discussion at the sentencing hearing, that he has some time, that maybe he can cooperate after this. It's outside the record, but I've not heard any indication that that has happened. So I don't know what the hope.
Basically, in return for the plea, he got, it's a life sentence regardless, right? He got the opportunity to cooperate, to get out from under the life sentence, basically.
That's right.
That was the only consideration for the promise, apparently, unless there's something else here that I'm missing.
That was the only consideration the government offered?
We're hearing a contract-based argument here that he didn't get anything for this plea, that it was totally illusory because it was going to be a life sentence either way, and all he got was this sort of opportunity to win the government's discretionary decision to make the substantial assistance motion.
As it turned out, I think that's probably what he primarily was bargaining for. But obviously, he got credit for acceptance of responsibility. And the irony here is we have a question of whether or not there was a sufficient factual basis. And he makes these exculpatory statements that come very close to not accepting responsibility. And the government agrees, part of the plea agreement, that she should receive credit for acceptance of responsibility. Once the PSR was completed and we knew that he faced a life sentence, a mandatory life sentence, acceptance of responsibility. But at the time the contract was made, there was consideration given in terms of acceptance of responsibility, the 1 point he gets for promptly notifying the government. They also didn't charge the heroin, so he didn't get this another count. You recall that he was found with both crack cocaine and the heroin.
Did this agreement also resolve the Northern District of Illinois charges in Rockford?
It did not.
Okay.
Did not.
I'm at the risk of being a little flip about something as serious as a life sentence. I was comparing this to the consideration I would get if I bought a fishing license. A fishing license, given my skills, would be of absolutely no value to me, but it would give me an opportunity to catch fish. As a practical matter, it wouldn't do me any good, but it would give me an opportunity to catch fish.
I think that's fair. I think we provided him with an opportunity and hope that he could cooperate. And typically, people that face a mandatory life sentence are able to provide some substantial assistance. He was not. But I would say our office and most officers are not churlish about making the motion when there is some significant assistance. And bear in mind, the reason he was facing mandatory minimum life is because of his substantial prior convictions. Mm-hmm. I mean, he only needed two, but I think he had five or something like that.
So there was a point in the Rule 11 colloquy where the defendant was expressing some equivocation or at least some
right.
lack of awareness that this substantial assistance motion was completely discretionary on the part of the government. And at that point, as I understand the record, the district court took a recess and allowed some consultation between attorney and client to iron out that important detail.
I don't know that that's – I think the context was when the judge said, and I have no discretion, I don't necessarily need to grant it. I'm sorry, not discretion. I have the discretion to whether or not to grant it. Even if the government were to move for a motion for a sentence under beneath the mandatory minimum, that doesn't mean that I would necessarily have to grant that. I still have the discretion to grant that, grant or deny it. And I think that's the point at which he said, oh, I didn't know that or something like that. Then they took a recess, talked to counsel, it got clarified and came back and clearly wanted to plead guilty, accepted those terms. If there are no further questions, I thank you for your time.
How much time?
I believe I've exhausted my time, if I'm correct, but would the court allow me 2 minutes? Thank you very much. I appreciate it. The court and counsel are discuss what defendant got for what he promised, and that's not my argument at all. I'm not arguing an after-the-fact look. They cite United States versus Williams, and I agree with United States versus Williams as a legal and a practical matter. If you promised it and that's what you got, then that's what you got. You can't complain about it later. That's weak in my mind. That's not what I'm arguing. I'm arguing in the inducement. In the fishing license, they said they were going to give you a fishing license, but on the fine print in the back, they didn't tell you about that there was a particular rider that said, in their sole discretion, you could only fish between 1 a.m. and 2 a.m. in February, on February 15th. You know, it would be illusory. You would pay the 20, you'd walk out and you think you had a fishing license, you'd get ready to go fishing and learn how to go fishing, but in fact, you don't have a fishing license at all. That would be an illusory term. In their sole discretion, they could bar you from fishing. That's not a license. It's a trick.
Why isn't an obligation limited by good faith sufficient to take care of the problem?
I believe it's United States versus Jeffries addressed that as well. The government attempted in a case to say, well, we offered good faith. They considered that illusory. Why? Because that is already a term in the contract. You can't offer a pre-existing duty as consideration. It's already consideration. You can't. It's illusory.
No. The argument is that we make a promise to give good faith consideration as to whether to make this motion. Why isn't that sufficient consideration to make the agreement non-illusory?
It's not my position. There's a Seventh Circuit case that says it's a pre-existing duty. You can't use a promise, something that already is occurring, as a promise. In other words, there's no movement.
That's a different problem. You're saying because of the mandatory life sentence, this is illusory because the decision about whether to make the 3553E motion is discretionary, sole discretion of the government. The government's response, as I understand it, is, at least in part, we are obligated to act in good faith and in making that evaluation, and the obligation to make that discretionary determination in good faith then is sufficient consideration.
That might be true, Judge. I don't agree, but that might be true in the one promise regarding cooperation, but it is not true at all regarding paragraph 18, where the defendant promised not to make any argument, the Sixth Amendment right. He promised not to make any argument.
Well, we don't look at this paragraph by paragraph, right? The whole deal works together, and what you need to have is some consideration by the defendant, and there's a lot, and some consideration by the government. There's a little bit here. But the defendant's in an extremely weak position.
Judge, I would agree with that, but what my argument is that they didn't perform. And United States versus Wade says if you promise it, you have to do it. That's my position.
So, wait a minute. They didn't perform because they didn't make the motion?
They didn't perform, yes.
Or because they didn't give good faith consideration?
There was nothing to consider. The defendant made no argument at sentencing. In agreement with the contract, there's nothing to consider. There's nothing at all. The government doesn't address it in my brief, so he hasn't addressed it here today. Your Honor, may I briefly, Your Honor, Judge Sykes,
briefly talked about the Rule 11 colloquy. The colloquy broke down, and what Your Honor was referring to was that the defendant said, I don't understand. And he has to understand. When the judge returned, they never went over those same questions. That in and of itself, under Rule 11, has to be a knowing plea. The factual basis later breaks down. The government says there's veracity in everything that's said. For every inculpation, there's an exculpation in that plea. Are there any other questions from the court?
Thank you, counsel.
I thank you for your time very much.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.